to me, one of the most interesting things about human beings is this whole phenomenon of religion and the incredible stickiness of it. And so one of the things that How God Works is trying to explore is what would cause billions of us to believe in imaginary beings and what makes it so sticky like that.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this week's episode, how interviews with the founder of HowStuffWorks.com works, being certain that Santa doesn't exist, and the definitive answer to the question, why doesn't God heal amputees? All coming up on this week's Humanist Hour. Hello, everybody. My name is Bo Bennett. I will be your host for this week's episode. There was a study done in 2012 that was published in the journal Science by the researcher named Will Gervais on analytical thinking and how it affects belief in the supernatural and belief in religion or God. And this was an amazing study because it actually did provide incredible evidence to the fact that it's this analytical thinking that actually does have a causal role in disbelief. Now, I bring this up because 93% of the scientists in the National Academy of Sciences do not believe in God, and you have to wonder why. And that makes perfect sense because they're analytical thinkers. Now, I bring this up because our guest for this week is a very analytical thinker. So I'll introduce him now. And I have the great pleasure of speaking with Mr. Marshall Brain. How are you, Marshall?
I'm great. I'm very glad to be here today.
Great. Thank you for being on the show. Well, Marshall, it's my understanding that you started a little website back in 1998 and sold it for a few bucks. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
You know, I kind of fell into the HowStuffWorks.com space. And, you know, it'd be nice to sit here and say that I had this genius plan and everything, but I just liked writing about how stuff works. And so I would write little articles on weekends. And no one cared, and no one cared, and no one cared. And then suddenly it became a very popular website and just started growing. And it had to turn from a hobby into a business. And then eventually Discovery Channel bought it. And getting to watch that whole process and getting to work with all the people I was able to work with was just fantastic.
Wow. It sounds like a very exciting time. And you started that in 1998, so that was way before the internet bubble burst. Did that big internet bubble burst affect you or the company at all, or were you pretty much not affected by it?
It was a gigantic nuclear bomb in the middle of that stuff. We were very, very fortunate to survive. Mm. And, you know, the thousands of other companies just did not make it through, but made it through. And then what saved us was Google AdWords and AdSense. When that came along, it gave websites an easy way to make money if they had traffic. And if it had not been for that, I don't know exactly what we would have done.
Wow. You know, it's interesting talking about this because I realized not too long ago when I spoke with some younger kids, I'll call them.
Okay.
They didn't know what the whole internet bubble was or the burst. They didn't experience it. You know, they might have read about it, but right. they weren't there. They weren't working through it. I think anybody running a technology company or an internet-based company that lived and made it through that really has they must have some thick skin.
There's definitely scar tissue that gets left behind. Between that, and just to summarize what that was like, pre the burst, there was money falling from the sky in millions of dollars chunks, and just about anybody could stick a bucket out and get it. And then, you know, there was a day, I guess in April maybe of 2001, where that rainfall just immediately stopped. And you had made plans against being able to get money pretty easily, and then suddenly there was no money from anywhere to be had. And then in September, 9/11 happened, and that just decimated the economy. So you could not raise any money, and you also could not make any money. And it was just a very bad time.
Yeah. All right. Well, let me ask you this, Marshall. How does stuff work?
You know, I'm the world's leading expert in how hard it is to know how everything works.
You're making the world smarter. So that's a great thing. So, but we're not here to talk about success, or we're not here to talk about the internet. We're here to talk about something related to humanism. In this case, you do have a interest in God and how God works. Before we talk about your new book, which is called How God Works, A Logical Inquiry on Faith, I have to ask you this. Given your success, isn't this proof that God exists?
Well, there are a lot of people who would agree with that statement, that, you know, if you're highly blessed, that God is the person who made that possible, or the being who made that possible. And that, it turns out, is a pretty common framework in the entrepreneurial community. There are quite a few outspoken folks who credit God with their success. I think the problem with that viewpoint is that if that is true, and if you listen to the doxology and it starts with "Praise God from whom all blessings flow," if all blessings flow from God, then you have to wonder how it is that so many people live in destitute. Like, why are the blessings flowing so disproportionately to some and not at all to others? And if you think about that, that would be an easy way to start thinking about the fact that God is imaginary and these things like the doxology are not true.
Yeah, you know, I was talking to somebody last week. We were talking about Calvinism and this whole idea of predestination or God's elect. And there's a big problem with this on many different levels, but also one on a humanistic perspective. Because just imagine if you really believed that everybody who's doing well in life is part of God's elect. Their wealth and their well-being is a reflection of the fact that they are part of God's elect, which also means that everybody you see that's not doing well, that may be living in a cardboard box on the street, may be down on their luck, may be socially disadvantaged, all of those people are not part of God's elect. Now, this isn't a guaranteed science, but it's an indication, according to Calvinism, that our well-being status and our wealth here on earth is a reflection of whether we are part of God's elect or not. And this is a huge problem when it comes to just judging other people.
Yeah, that goes back to the divine rights of kings as well. You know, that whole notion that God, like, if you, it's a good thing to look up sometime, you know, we'll, there's you, me, and the audience. For, you know, hey, audience, go look up the divine right of kings sometime. And it just, you know, the notion was that God chose this person as king, and this person has ultimate power and can do whatever he wants to the rest of humanity. And it's kind of a cancerous thought process, but a lot of people buy into it. Yep. And it's obviously great for the king to promulgate that idea, and I agree with you. It's just a terrible way to structure your thought process.
Yeah. Well, Marshall, you have some very controversial websites out there, along with some very controversial YouTube channels. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Well, I started, you know, when I was in college, I started writing a book that became "Why Won't God Heal Amputees?" And that question, "Why won't God heal amputees?" did not exist out in the public space prior to the publication of that book. And I couldn't find a publisher for it, and so I just put it on the internet as the website, whywon'tgodhealamputees.com. And it's been really interesting to watch how that question has resonated with people. If you go type, you know, God and amputees into Google, there are hundreds of thousands of pages and cartoons and memes and so on working on that question. And it, you know, it kind of took on a little life of its own. So that has been fun and interesting to watch. But that website was just a way of starting a conversation about the fact that God is imaginary. And then there became a spin-off website, because Why Won't God Heal Amputees.com is written like a book. And I got a lot of requests for something a little more granular. So GodIsImaginary.com is a sister website that is just broken up into a bunch of individual pieces. And in this case, it's 50 pieces. And then I've been adding bonus pieces recently. So then there was also a YouTube channel that has gotten millions and millions of views that has videos that are derived from those two websites. And so, you know, so I've been fortunate to be able to reach millions and millions of people with the message that God is imaginary. And I know that, you know, thousands of people have actually made the jump over to rationality, you know, in part because they encountered those websites. Usually it's a long process and it involves much more than just one website, but I have definitely been fortunate to have helped a number of people make the jump over to the real world.
Excellent. Well done, you. I'm wondering, your websites are very controversial. They certainly might rub people the wrong way, especially Christians. Have people ever contacted you and said, Marshall, you're a dick, I don't like you? and then maybe a couple months later they get back and say, Marshall, you're awesome, you know, thank you so much.
I get, Marshall, you're a dick, for a wide variety of reasons. And that is just one of them. So it is, well, to go back to something you said earlier about the amount of time it takes to make the transition, one of the things I'm fascinated with is, and really to me, one of the most interesting things about human beings is this whole phenomenon of religion and the incredible stickiness of it. Like if you're exposed to it as a child, which most of us are, it is a remarkably sticky thing. I don't know that there's anything as sticky as the idea of religion and God and prayer and all of that. And so one of the things that how God works is trying to explore is what would cause billions of us to believe in imaginary beings and what makes it so sticky like that. And what's happening inside our heads to reinforce the ideas and things like that. And it really is a quite intriguing aspect of being a human.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and I'm speaking with Mr. Marshall Brain. Your book is called How God Works, A Logical Inquiry on Faith. And this, I went on Amazon, and today is January 16th, and it said that it was out of stock. So is it not out yet?
No, it came out on the 6th, and it sold out.
Oh, good for you.
So, yeah, Amazon ran out of stock yesterday.
Okay.
So I find that fascinating that in the 21st century we still run out of stock on things. You would think the computers would look at the rate of flow and
right
and so on, because the book comes from one of the largest publishers in the United States. There certainly is no shortage of inventory in the warehouse, but something, you know, Amazon had a lot of copies and they all sold.
Well, so here's what I find fascinating, Marshall. In the 21st century, you don't have this book on ebook.
Isn't that funny? It is on the Nook side. It is electronic, but for some reason it hasn't come out on the Kindle side yet.
You got to place a call in your publisher.
There you go.
How about that? All right.
It's a good.
So here's the description, or this is just a little segment from the description. It says, "Does God exist? Using an intellectually rigorous scientific approach, Marshall Brain sets out to resolve the eternal debate once and for all. Very powerful statement. And then from your background info that you sent me, it said, or you wrote, the goal of this book is to show people that they can know with certainty that God is imaginary. Very powerful claims, and I want to talk about those. Let's start with, if we can, defining certainty. In your mind, can one be certain a proposition is true as long as there remains a possibility of that proposition being false? Is that clear?
Well, this is a great philosophical question, and we could go – it's a huge space that we could spend hours on. But let me ask you this, and I've done a lot of public speaking around the book, and there's a very uniform feeling about this. If I ask you or anyone in the audience or any adult in America, Santa Claus, real or imaginary – every adult will say that Santa is imaginary. And now I ask you, are you certain of that? And they will say, yes, I am absolutely certain that Santa Claus is imaginary. So, you know, and we could bring some high-powered philosophy PhDs into the room, and they would tell us that we can't know that with certainty. But in a normal human being sense, we all know with absolute certainty that Santa is imaginary. And that brings up two things. First, how do we know that Santa is imaginary? And then why are we so certain of that knowledge? Like, what is leading us to feel so confident in our belief or our knowledge that Santa is, in fact, imaginary? And that is one of the core kind of linchpins of the book, is understanding how we know something and then how we gain certainty on it.
Okay. So if I could paraphrase, we're talking about two different definitions of certainty, or two different ways to look at it. One is from a philosophical sense. And this, as you said, when the PhDs in philosophy talk about certainty, it gets very tricky. And many of them will say, well, you really can't be certain about anything. However, what you're talking about, the casual use of the word certainty. Like if my wife asks me, hey, did you take out the garbage? Yes, I'm certain I did. You know, and then I'm thinking, well, you know, I'm 99% sure I did. But essentially, that's what we mean by certainty. So that's what you're talking about in the book. You're talking about the casual use of the word certainty, the same way that we could be certain that Santa Claus doesn't exist.
Yes, and we could talk about this for hours. I do not necessarily buy the philosophical argument that we can't show that Santa is imaginary. So, and where this gets really conflated is in a conversation you can have with a fundamentalist, mm-hmm. who will bring up this point and say, you know, and we'll sit there and make the argument that we can't know that Santa is imaginary, when in fact we can know that Santa is imaginary. You can make this argument that he can exist, and to make it, you might have to say, well, he exists on another planet. You know, there are these things, but we do know with certainty that Santa Claus is imaginary, and we have a set of mental concepts that let us get to that certainty. So it's a little more than just a difference between colloquial and precise academic speech. But it would take hours for us to drill down into that.
I understand. I've been in a lot of those debates myself. And I think one of the key points when we're talking about God generally, when we say that, can you be certain that God is imaginary or that he doesn't exist? Before you get into that question, what you really need to do is you need to define God. What is God and what is his attributes? Because if you just define God as some unknown entity, at the very basic level, then does an unknown entity exist? Well, sure, I guess. But once you start defining God as the being who said you can't eat shellfish, the being who said that if you're homosexual, you need to be stoned to death, and all of these different attributes, then it's easier to accept that this version of God does not exist. I think the same thing like with Santa, from a philosophical standpoint. If we were to discuss and debate if Santa is imaginary or not, the first thing I would have to do is say, well, what is Santa? Are we just talking about a guy named St. Nicholas who existed maybe in the 1500s? Well, you know, maybe he did exist, but he might have. But are we defining Santa as the guy who goes down everybody's chimney on December 24th, 25th and leaves presents? Well, that's a different story. And we could easily come to the conclusion that he's imaginary given that definition of Santa.
That's perfect. That's exactly the place that a critical thinker has to get with God. And so chapter 4 of How God Works, it takes Christianity and says, let's define the Christian God. And here are his attributes or his properties or his claims, and let's list them, and let's agree that everybody agrees on these, mm-hmm. despite the thousand sects of Christianity that exist out there. There are a set of common things, attributes of God. And like you said, with Santa, you know, the going down the chimney is one attribute, and the flying sleigh is another attribute, and the factory at the North Pole is another attribute, and so on. You can show that all those attributes are false, and therefore Santa is imaginary, and you can follow that exact same process with God. Although it's interesting that, like, for your book on marketing, the interesting thing about God is that the structures that have been built around some of God's attributes are so fascinating and so intricate. It is amazing. And prayer is a great example of that. Like, people can convince themselves that prayer is real, even though if you examine it, it is clear that the belief in prayer is a superstition. But convincing someone of that because of the mental foibles of human beings can be a challenge if they're not critical thinkers.
Yeah. I definitely want to talk a lot more about prayer, but before I do, let's get back to this idea of imaginary. How do we define imaginary, and can we prove something is imaginary? I believe I saw one of the videos that you've done recently where you talked about the placebo effect and clinical studies. So can you talk a little bit about that? I didn't get to hear your full conversation on that, but I did find it interesting.
Sure. So we prove that things are imaginary all the time in the drug space, the pharmaceutical space, and we do that using clinical trials. So there's a chapter in the book that talks about how do scientists take a drug and decide, are its effects real or are its effects imaginary? And it turns out they have to go to quite a bit of trouble to weed out the placebo effect and the biases people have and the effects of the actual researchers that they can have on the outcome of the experiment, sometimes unconsciously. You have to actually go to quite a bit of trouble, but we can take a drug and we can take its claims and we can decide whether the claimed effects are real or imaginary. And we do that thousands of times a year with these clinical trials. So, you know, thinking about God, we can take claims that are made about God and especially about prayer and subject them to the same scientific process and demonstrate whether the claims about prayer are real or imaginary.
Okay. Well, maybe if you could make this a little bit more clear to our listeners and myself by perhaps using prayer as an example and walking us through a prayer study.
Well, if we were going to do it with prayer, we'd come up with our hypothesis or our assertion, mm-hmm. that there is a God who answers prayers. Let's say that's our hypothesis, and we're trying to prove, is that true or false? Now, let's just go back one second. When you talked about the control and the experimental group, and you had the placebo and the real medicine, what the clinical trial is trying to show is, does the real medicine give us any effect that is greater than placebo? So if we look at those two groups and they both have the same effect, what we're measuring is an identical placebo effect on both groups. And if the medicine is actually doing anything, its effect will rise above the placebo effect and give us a measure, like an indicator in the experimental group. So, and we have to, you know, like we have to go to a lot of trouble to get that right. We have to randomize people into the two groups. The two groups have to be big enough. The researchers can't know which is the placebo and which is the real medicine and all this stuff. So with prayer, and there actually has been a lot of studies, and the most famous one is a $2.4 million study of the effects of prayer on heart patients. They actually had three groups that they used, and the groups were quite large and of an appropriate size to get real data out of. And they had one group – well, two of the groups were prayed for, and one of the groups was not. And when I say prayed for, I mean that they had Christian churchgoers enrolled in the study who were doing the remote praying for the patients who had had heart surgery. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they do that whole trial, and what they find is that all three groups do the same. There's no there's no difference above placebo for any of the three groups, except there is this one interesting thing. One of the two groups that's prayed for, they tell them that they're being prayed for, and the second group that's being prayed for, they don't. They tell them they might get prayed for, they might not. And the first group, the group that knows they're being prayed for, actually does worse.
Yeah.
There's this weird reverse placebo effect. And the no one really has a definitive answer as to why that happened, but the theory is that the people who know they're being prayed for feel some kind of obligation or stress to get better.
Right.
You know, because if they're being prayed for, they ought to get better. And so, you know, and that stress, like all stress, causes a worse outcome.
Sure. All right. So you talked about a lot of interesting things there, and you did bring into prayer. So let's start talking about that. But when we're talking about proving something is imaginary, and talking about doing these trials, we're looking for an effect, and that's the key here. And when we're talking about prayer, well, that's an easy one, because many Christians will say that prayer is effective. And let me take a step back and talk about that for a moment, because when we talk about prayer, there's basically two kinds of prayer. There's petitionary prayer, what we call it. That's what you were talking about in this study, for like one group of people praying for another group of people for something to happen to them. So you're asking God for something, allegedly, and you're hoping that God will give that person what you're asking for. So that's petitionary prayer, like asking God for something. The other kind of prayer is might be related to some kind of like a meditation or a self-affirmation or a gratitude. So this is the kind of prayer that your 5-year-old might go to bed and say, you know, thank you, God, for my friends and my family and all the good things that happened to me today. So that's a little bit different, because studies have shown that that kind of prayer is more of like an affirmation of gratitude, and it is effective. But it's not the prayer that's effective, it's the gratitude that's effective. So when we're talking about taking out these different variables and these different factors and getting it down to its core, it is essentially the gratitude and thinking about the good things. But as you mentioned with the petitionary prayer studies, they take out all those different factors, and we're looking specifically at the petition part. And study after study after study has shown that there's been no significant effect there. So in that sense, we could say that prayers are ineffective. Now, here's my question to you, and perhaps my challenge to you, Marshall Brain. Okay. Does that demonstrate or prove that God is imaginary, or just that petitionary prayer is imaginary or ineffective?
Okay, great. So first, the distinction you're drawing is an excellent one, because there are different types of prayer. And if we look up prayer in the dictionary, it talks about petitionary or intercessory prayer, you know, asking God to give us something, and then also the gratitude side of it, thanking God for giving us something. And there are actually several modalities of prayer. And the point you're bringing up, which is excellent, is that if we use prayer as a form of meditation, meditation does work. And you can go to the Mayo Clinic website and you can read about the benefits of meditation. But that is, you know, that is meditation, and it's just being renamed as prayer in that case. And there's a whole science around happiness and gratitude and gratefulness that, as you mentioned, is true and valid. If we take on a position of gratitude and we keep a gratitude journal, and that's in our four, you know, that's a big part of our life, we will be happier. And that's been scientifically proven. And again, prayer just takes over the science of gratefulness or gratitude and renames it as prayer. So, you know, that does work as well. But if we're here talking about prayers of intercession, that part we know for a fact does not work at all. And so ask me your question again, because I've forgotten.
All right. Well, that was an excellent summary of the whole difference of petitionary okay. prayer and praying for gratitude or something along those lines.
I'm sorry.
No, this is great. So the idea that can we prove that God is imaginary, what we've demonstrated so far that is that petitionary prayer is imaginary, not necessarily God.
Excellent.
So before I get into my thoughts on that, and I want to ask you yours, like how would you address that?
Okay. So we know that prayer is a superstition, and you know, like there's six chapters in the book that help you get at that. So now we look at God and his definition in the Bible, and his definition generally dogmatically inside of Christianity, and God is defined as a prayer answering being. So once we prove that God does not answer prayers, we've taken out this big chunk of the definition of God, and we've shown that that is not true.
Welcome back to the Humanist Hour. My name is Bo Bennett, and we're speaking with Mr. Marshall Brain, author of the book How God Works, A Logical Inquiry on Faith.
So now your choice is to either accept that because that's the case, we have this giant data point that God is imaginary, and then we just assemble a whole bunch of other data points that all point in the same direction, and like Santa, we prove that God is imaginary. Or we redefine God as a being who doesn't answer prayers. And at that point, we have a new God being that we're creating. Mm-hmm. We're just, you know, manufacturing out of thin air this new thing that has some attributes but does not answer prayers. And at that point, we aren't talking about the Christian God anymore.
Right.
So we have to deal with the whole process of defining and dealing with this new being that we've created over here out of our imaginations because of the data we have in the real world.
Okay. So we're saying that God is defined biblically as somebody who answers prayers. And if you read the New Testament, it is very clear that God answers prayers. However, you will hear from a lot of Christians that, well, God doesn't answer all prayers, only prayers that he wants to address, which of course makes you think, okay, well, wait, why am I praying? Why am I doing petitionary prayer, or is there any effectiveness? And of course, that would contradict many of Jesus' statements in the Bible directly about ask anything in the Father's name and you will get it. Of course, then later on, people will point to some, well, he meant, you know, if it's within God's will, or if your faith is strong enough, and so forth. There's a lot of a lot of little catches that come along with those claims. But
can we hold on that thought for one second?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so this is an interesting and fascinating part of Christianity, is that there is this ability in the Christian mind to hold multiple contradictory thoughts simultaneously and to switch between them, often, you know, a minute apart. So we have the concept that God answers prayers. That's one part of Christianity. Another part is God is hidden, and he can't expose himself or it would take away faith. And then we also have the concept that God has a plan for us, all the way down to the day we are born and the day we will die and so on. And those three things all contradict each other. You can't have a prayer-answering being that's hidden, and you can't pray to somebody who has a plan that's set in stone, because it's, the prayer isn't going to have any effect. So if you can get a Christian to admit that those ideas contradict each other and they have to pick one, as soon as they abandon the other two, then they're on their way to understanding that God is imaginary.
Well, the big question that we all need to ask, believers and non-believers, is this. How can we show that God exists? Can we show that God exists through any effects in the world? And one of those ways that some people claim is the effectiveness of prayer. But as we've already discussed, study after study, we show that there is no effect when it comes to prayer. When some people might say, you know, I prayed to God about a new job and I got that new job. Well, of course, that's the confirmation bias, and you're remembering the hits, forgetting the misses. There's a lot of different reasons why sometimes it works, because of pure statistics and what you ask for and so forth. So there's nothing miraculous about that. But what I've seen happen in the past is people who start to become a little bit more scientifically minded, a little bit more critical thinking in their religiosity, start to do away with these effects that they used to believe in, these superstitions, if you will. And now what they've done is they've defined God in such a way where it's basically unfalsifiable, untestable, and there is no way to prove or disprove his existence in the universe.
I totally agree with that. And it is a huge and amazing phenomenon. And second, the interesting side effect is you will have someone say to you, well, God does answer prayers, but he does it in such a way that it's not statistically detectable. And I hear that a lot. And so the answer to that is, well, here over in the real world of science, if we can't statistically detect it, that's our proof that it's imaginary. Right. And so what you've done is you've taken the proof that it's imaginary and you've completely ignored it. And this is an aspect of why religion is so fascinating. And it's so sticky. Like, how could people get to that point where they just discard basically the whole scientific process and the whole scientific method? And they'll do that with the whole science of evolution, and they'll do that with statistics, and they'll ignore the fact that God won't heal amputees, and will come up with a whole rationalization for that. And all of this stuff to prop up this thing, this belief in this higher power. But then you have to step back and ask why. Like, what are you getting out of like demeaning yourself to that level, and you know, getting to a position that's just ridiculous? Why are you doing it? And that, I there's a section of the book about that. But I don't think I fully understand what's driving that process, and it still just amazes me, and it's fascinating to me.
Well, I could shed some light on that, but first I want to address one of the points that you asked, or you mentioned before, about Christians who will say, well, prayer does work, it's just not statistically testable. The best answer to that is, say, what if I told you that water cures cancer, but it's not statistically testable? And once you create an analogy like that, that's so right. Ridiculous, they might stop and think about that and say, okay, I see what I'm doing here. Now, to answer your bigger question, you know, what is it? What is it about religious belief that's so powerful? Christianity especially, because not all religious belief is equal, but Christianity, Islam is powerful. And you think about, what is it about these things? Well, I'll just speak for Christianity, because that's my background, and that's the religion of our culture, the primary religion of our culture, so I could talk a little bit more about that. But if you think about it, this idea of hell, this idea of your soul and eternal suffering and torture for like unimaginable torture if you don't accept this on faith, if you don't believe this. If you do have that belief, that one belief that if you do not believe in Jesus, if you do not believe that Jesus was the Son of God, you will spend eternity suffering in hell. Then everything else, every no matter what the science shows, no matter what logic, and no matter what anything shows, it's just incomparable to this whole idea of hell. And you will twist facts. You will change your beliefs and change your mind. You will confabulate to death until you could eventually convince yourself that, this stuff might be true. It's a wonderful thing that the religious people have done, marketing-wise. It added in this idea of hell and the promise of heaven, the ultimate carrot and the ultimate stick.
Right?
Yeah.
That's an excellent perspective. If we just went one step further, why would you believe in a being that has created this amazing place of eternal conscious torture?
Right. Yeah.
How do you get to that point?
Well, not only a being, but a benevolent being, a perfectly good benevolent, a being who loves you. Like, it's incomprehensible as well. But you know, there's a justification that goes on. It's very interesting. The whole psychology of religion. It's incredibly interesting. Let's move on to one chapter in your book before we finish up here. You ask about why we just don't ask God or Jesus to appear. Why not?
Well, so there's two interesting parts to that. The first is that in the Bible, there's actually a story about a prophet asking God to appear, and God, according to the myth that's in the Bible, God actually does make his presence known. And a fascinating aspect of that is that the other God doesn't show up. And there's no mercy for that. If in this test, if you call upon a God to manifest itself and it doesn't, then that God is imaginary, according to the Bible. And all the prophets of that God, all the ministers or priests or whatever, are killed in the Bible because the God didn't manifest itself. So you look at that and you say, why don't we just apply that exact same test to God? Like, why doesn't he have to appear on demand as described in the Bible? And if you ask someone this question, you'll get, again, an amazing array of rationalization and so on. But the Bible does indicate that we should be able to apply this test to God anytime we want and get a knowable effect. And the punishment for God not appearing to any rational person is completely repulsive. So if you could get someone to sit and think through that, that would be another indicator, strong indicator, that God is imaginary because he fails his own test. Hmm. And it's fascinating. With Jesus, it's the same kind of thing. You know, Jesus claims in many places that he'll answer your prayers, and he claims that he's in our midst. And so you should just be able to pray to him and have him show up. That, you know, is axiomatic based on what the Bible says, and that's, of course, not true either, and is another great indicator that Jesus is imaginary. Hmm.
Well, this is where people commit what I call the spiritual fallacy when they say, well, what he meant by that is he'll spiritually show up. And when you put spiritually in front of anything, then obviously you have a nice little out. But you do bring up an interesting point about the whole Old Testament God, how he was everywhere. That you call on the Old Testament God and boom, he's there. He'll turn people to pillars of salt. He'll stop the sun. He'll do everything. Miracles were abundant. They were everywhere. Why? Because the writers were writing in the past about things that already supposedly happened, not about things in the present or not things about in the future. So it's easier to make God this miraculous thing that commits, that basically is like a Penn and Teller stage show with his miracles. But in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 16, there's a verse that talks about how we shouldn't test God. And I often hear a lot of Christians bring that up. But here's something interesting. If you go into openbible.com or go into any Bible and ask the question, what does God say about testing or testing in the Bible, testing God in the Bible, you'll come up with sites like Open Bible that'll show all the verses related to that. And you see how the Bible is actually constructed. Basically, for any questions, it'll give you answers on both sides or all along the spectrum. So whatever position you're actually advocating, you could pick and choose from the Bible to support your position. Just as with this question, you could show in the Bible, like you did, that in the Bible they actually test God. But you could also show in the Bible where they say you cannot test God or you should not test God. And that's where people start playing little cherry-picking games.
Well, that's, you know, that's a part where you just ask, again, what are you doing or what are you thinking that would cause you to get down inside this rabbit hole so deeply? But the ambiguity of the Bible, the fact that you can make it say anything you want, is another chapter of the book. It's another proof point that God is imaginary, because if God were real, we would know what he's thinking. You know, he would make it clear, homosexuality, is it good or bad? You can read the Bible and come to any conclusion along the spectrum, as you said.
Yeah.
And you can point to a verse and prove your position, but you can also prove any other position. And in reality, you can't have a omnipotent being who is completely ambiguous and won't resolve the ambiguity. It's just not possible.
Yeah. Ah, ambiguity, religion's best friend.
Right. So the point of the book is, here you are as a Christian. If you can bring yourself to the point where you can think critically about what you believe, you will find very quickly that God is imaginary. And it's just getting a person to be willing to make that transition, like to abandon the fears they have and the false beliefs. And that is the sticky point,
yeah.
The thing about religion.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful book, and I will purchase it as soon as it's available, but now I can't. I can't get it no matter how badly I want it. And I honestly, Marshall, I haven't purchased a paper book in years. Everything's ebook these days for me. I just really like the ebook technology. So you got to place a call to your publisher and tell them that Bo wants ebook format on Amazon.
I will make that my next task.
All right. Excellent. So people can get your book and find out more information about it where, when it's available.
Well, it's sold out on Amazon today. I'm assured that it'll be available again at Amazon next week. It's available at Barnes & Noble. The bookstore has it on their website and on the Nook and in bookstores. So by next week, the whole supply chain problem should be resolved and you can get it just about anywhere.
All right. And your personal website is what?
MarshallBrain.com is my personal place. And there's also a site for the book called HowGodWorks.com.
All right. Marshall, this has been a wonderful discussion. Thank you so much. It's a lot of fun talking about this stuff, and especially with you, so thank you.
Well, thank you for your time today. This has been a fantastic conversation. I'm glad we had it.
All right. You take care.
Thanks.
All right, that was Mr. Marshall Brain, author of the book How God Works, A Logical Inquiry on Faith. Also, the founder of HowStuffWorks.com, great website. And now it's owned by the Discovery Channel, apparently. Big site. A lot of good podcasts there as well if you're interested in other type of podcasts, non-humanist based. But that doesn't necessarily mean they're bad. It just means they're not as good as this one. Prayer is definitely an interesting topic that always comes up in debate, or at least comes up quite frequently, because it is one of the ways that believers do believe that God can prove himself in a way in this world. But of course, you could never, even if we do find that praying does have a significant difference And if you do pray for something, it actually will happen. And a petitionary prayer does work, which it doesn't. But let's just say if it did, you still could not prove that it is the Judeo-Christian God that's behind that. It could be some celestial wizard on another planet, in another solar system. It could be anything. But of course, that really doesn't matter. We would take the conversation to that next level if we ever got there, but we didn't. So if people redefine God in such a way where God really doesn't have any effect on the world, at least nothing demonstrable, nothing that you could actually test, nothing that you could falsify, then in a way, these believers are kind of like deists. That, yeah, there's a God who just kind of created everything and set everything in motion, but really doesn't interact with the world. But also, if you are claiming that God wrote this book and we need to follow these instructions and we know the will of this God, well, that's certainly an effect in this world, and that's certainly an effect that he or it or she or whatever would have on humanity. Show me the evidence. And by the evidence, I don't mean a beautiful sunset. Sorry, that doesn't work. All right, folks, well, thank you very much for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. If you do have any feedback, we'd love to hear from you. Send an email to humanisthour@americanhumanist.org or call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. Till next time, my name is Bo Bennett. Bye-bye, everybody. Have a good week.